What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the CoinSpice podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at CoinSpice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
All right, so I've got the bon vivant, the raconteur, the renaissance man of the interwebs. It is Sal the Agorist on Twitter, Sally Mayweather, New Libertarian blogger, the Agora podcast. This guy does it all. He's a meme master. He's hilarious, thoughtful, and he's also an anarchist Austrian. So we just are going to get along famously. But before we start the episode and why I have him here, man, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
No, dude, thank you for having me. Like I was telling you before we came on, this is like, I love CoinSpice. It's like an honor to be here with you guys. It's like I'm usually on the listening end, so now I get a taste of the back end of things, which is always cool.
Boom. Well, we love having you, and we're huge fans, all of us. I didn't realize how many of your memes from Twitter I jack and share. So you're definitely someone we're very fond of.
Got to spread them around.
For sure. So let's get into it then. I think we have to start with your relationship, digital one anyway, with Saifedean, Professor Saifedean Amuz.
And is he a professor still?
Yeah, well, at least he was.
Okay.
Right? Of some university in Lebanon, I believe. And his kind of rise to prominence. But can you kind of tell us who Saif is?
Yeah, Saif wrote the Bitcoin Standard. He's sort of the go-to guy for the maximalists, although what I've come to find out is that the maximalists are themselves divided. So Saif represents about half of the maximalists. And I think the other half are probably represented by Nick Szabo. But Saif Saif's the author of the Bitcoin Standard. He is sort of their, as far as I can tell, the only economist who subscribes to the maximalist position. And him and I, we got into it on Twitter a few times. The first time wasn't even really that public. It was just over like something stupid about climate change or something. And then after that, I could always tell he was kind of cold towards me. You know, he would like retweet my memes and stuff before that. And then I kind of got the cold shoulder.
He's sort of an interesting personality. So he's an academician, and as someone who's kind of fond of the Austrian school, it's sort of nice to have a dude like that, you know, come in and want to be a part of both Bitcoin and the Misesian tradition. But he's a little on the aggressive side, right, in terms of his personality.
He's very, very feisty. He's very, very feisty, which is fine. I don't care, like, you know, the ad hom stuff, the name calling, and that's fine. I'm not really here for all that, despite, you know, I do enjoy the memes and stuff, but I'm really much more in it for the freedom aspects, the liberty aspects of all this. That's really the only reason why I'm active in any of this stuff, you know? So,
but your main interactions with him come via Twitter.
Oh, 100%, 100%. He didn't follow me, so I couldn't even. I wanted to get him on the podcast long ago, but I couldn't DM him because he didn't follow me. So it was only through that referral link. I posted like this referral link for local.bitcoin, and he responded. Or no, actually, I'm sorry. Let me back up. First, I posted like a reading list for Bitcoin maximalists that was like Origins of Money by Carl Menger. There was a Hayek essay in there and something by Mises, and he responded something to the effect of like, oh, well, I've read them all and I'm still not stupid enough to be a B casher or something like that, you know? Hmm. So I was like, all right, cool. Come on the show and we'll discuss the economics of this stuff, you know? And
he didn't accept it, right?
No, at first he didn't respond at all. And then that tweet that I put out, like, come on the show, that invite got a bunch of likes. And, you know, I could see in my notifications, he's liking it. As he's ignoring that invite, he's, you know, liking and retweeting all of the, you know, other posts in that thread. But finally, I guess the peer pressure had built to the point where he had to respond. And he was like, all right, yeah, I'll come on the show. But give me two weeks or something like that because I'm busy. So I said, okay, cool, no problem. I'll wait for you to DM me. Like a month goes by and I hit him up and he's like, oh, yeah, okay, fine. Yeah, we'll do it. And then it really feels like he was just looking for an easy way out, because, you know, as soon as I posted a referral link, which he's seen me do before, he just kind of like, that was his way out, you know. But and it was really
the referral link you're talking about is to local Bitcoin, the Bitcoin.com sort of non-custodial, I guess, BCH exchange, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And really, you know, they have like this contest, and I think you get like a little referral fee. It's like 20% of like this little fee, but that has really nothing to do with any of it. I'm really just sharing it because, you know, the blogging and the podcasting, it's all about agorism. So I really think that this is a great way to get involved in counter economics, you know? So I just try to, people always ask me, what are some good ways to get involved? And then this is a great way that you can get involved in the counter economy and make some money. So that's really the only reason why I was, you know, trying to share it around and get people involved in it. But I guess he didn't like it though. So
that's putting it mildly. So before we get to his reaction, what I should have asked before, maybe just a little bit about Konkin and agorism and sort of the counter economics idea. Can you explain to the listeners what that is?
Yeah. The whole idea is that, counter-economics and agorism are synonyms. The idea is that we can peacefully create liberty by subverting or undermining the state using the, you know, free market principles. So we look at like what Ross did, Ross Ulbricht, how he created a free and open, uncensored market, which ironically, as a side note, was dependent on peer-to-peer cash. But that's another point that I try to point out to the maximalist. But you know, also look at Cody Wilson, how he kind of was able to, using 3D printing and modern technology, he was able to subvert the ATF and create more liberty for people. Satoshi Nakamoto himself, obviously, was able to subvert the banking cartel. We look at how the SLP token is sort of subverting the SEC and FINRA. So all of these ways are peaceful means of creating a revolution, really. It's kind of like Gandhi's Satyagraha, if you think about it. It's
right.
Instead of like going out with guns and knives and killing politicians, this is a more peaceful way to do it. It's a more logically consistent way of going about it.
It's a fascinating way to live, and I know that there are more and more people embracing it, either as a half measure, in parts, and just kind of where they can, but
It
amounts to what, like civil disobedience, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's essentially nonviolent civil disobedience. You know, participation in the gray or black markets. As long as there's some sort of activity, as long as you're doing something, you know, like I said, in relation to black or gray markets, you are behaving in a counter-economic fashion. So even just, like I said, trading on local.bitcoin is a great way to get started for people who are like, you know, look, nobody wants to go to jail. I'm not saying go out there and start, you know,
right,
having shipments of heroin come into the local ports. That's not what I'm saying. Although that is, you know, I don't have a problem with that if that's what you want to do. As an anarchist, God bless, but that's not, you know, that's not the point that I'm trying to make.
Yeah, there was an economist he was a journalist a few years back. He called it the French word, I guess, was débrouillard or the de-economy. And he talked about this sort of intellectual property, sort of, you know, people trade beneath permissioned, licensed spheres of economic activity, and especially in places like Africa and in some of the third world. If you add it all up, this sort of, you know, agorist idea, this kind of underground, what would be at the very least a black market, in U.S. eyes, without, you know, licenses and zoning permits and intellectual property rights and all this other stuff, it amounts to either the third or the fourth largest economy in the world. So this is not a, you know, like a trivial idea that just, you know, white people in California or on the East Coast do. This is all over the world, and this really does feed and help a lot of people who otherwise are just, you know, shut out.
Absolutely. I would even take it a step further and say that anywhere you've seen a sort of communist or socialist or just any tyrannical state overthrown, it's mainly, by and large, been as a result of counter-economic activity. So like if you look at the American Revolution, look at the tax protests, or if you look, there's all of the black market activity in the Soviet Union is ultimately what ended that god-awful disaster, thank God. And, you know, the other point is, too, is a black market is the only true anarchic market, right? And, you know, as Jeffrey Tucker says, the market loves you. So you look at a place like North Korea where the government is starving people. It's the black marketeers who are smuggling food in to keep people alive, you know, not the government. So
it's just crazy how it gets this this twisted idea. But I'm glad we had a chance to kind of shine some more light on it. So that's where sort of you're coming from, and maybe even Safe has some sympathy towards that idea, if not outright support of being a fellow traveler. And he's at this point in the story agreed to come on the Agora podcast, which is excellent. I recommend everybody listen, and we'll link to it in the show notes. Then you do the referral link to this, you know, which is right up your alley type non-escrow Bitcoin Cash exchange. And he says what?
At that point, then he says, well, there goes our interview, canceled. And then he blocks me. So
there it is.
I don't know. You know, I don't know what happened, but I don't know why I got so mad, but that was the end of that. As, you know, the only thing I could think of is at the same time I started, I was dropping some Carl Menger quotes in the same thread that kind of, I think just, you know, absolutely destroy his argument. So I think that, I don't want to say he was like, you know, I don't think he was scared to debate me or anything like that. And I didn't even want to debate him. I just wanted to have a conversation with him. I just, you know, to question the narrative in the main narrative of his book in an efficient manner is not good for book sales, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's my guess as well. He, about a year ago did, and I don't want to turn this into a whole thing about Safe, but it does lead us to sort of the point of the episode here and the economics of BTC maximalism, which you brilliantly wrote about recently, kind of as a, maybe in lieu of having him on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But about a year ago, Safe was on the Tom Woods podcast, and Tom at that time was kind of not, you know, he does, Tom Woods is a kind of a libertarian podcaster, kind of an anarchist fellow traveler. Certainly sympathetic in a lot of ways to the Agora's cause and so on and so forth. But he had Safe on because of the Bitcoin idea. And so somehow, some way, poor Tom decided to ask him about Bitcoin Cash and BTC sticking in terms of fees and whatever else. And ooh, did that not go well?
I didn't know that. Oh, I have to listen to that episode.
Yeah, I'll link to that as well. And he just kind of snaps at him. Look, if we're going to keep talking about this, I don't want to waste any more time on this Bitcoin. It's ridiculous, asinine. You know,
is that really what he said? Oh,
seriously?
Wow.
Yeah.
You guys see the link after we get off.
Yeah, well, Woods just recently had him on again. I haven't heard the more recent episode.
No, I was afraid to listen to it because I'm just, it drives me crazy just to listen to the nonsense.
anyway, he's an interesting character, and he, again, as you say, he's the go-to, you know, sort of guy, and I've seen a lot of really great people hold the book up, and I think, again, a lot of us are just happy to have anybody talking about these issues, and you and I are so cranky, we like to sort of, well, hold on, you know, listen to the implications of what you're saying.
Right, yeah.
But I think everybody else is kind of like, who cares? This is fun. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so you get into, on your blog, The New Libertarian, on August 25th, you wrote a really cool piece here called The Economics of BTC Maximalism. And you've already kind of, you know, agreed that this was sort of in lieu of the interview you would have done with him. And you go into BTC maximalists and why this idea is fundamentally flawed in two ways. But would you describe yourself as a, and I kind of already know the answer, but would you describe yourself as a maximalism, like for Bitcoin Cash, or you know, are you maximalist in the currency idea at all?
Well, I consider myself to be a sound money maximalist. So in the context of cryptocurrency, I'm really a peer-to-peer cash maximalist.
Right.
I think that is the utility of cryptocurrency. So whatever chain can perform that function best, I think is the one that is at least assuming the initial utility in the best possible fashion. But I'm not sure that that alone will be sufficient to propel a chain to becoming the sole monetary standard. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And I think the way Jeffrey Tucker describes it is that he's a Mungarian, right? He's
the
competition maximalist. He wants them to sort of fight it out.
Exactly. And, you know, in the one sense, the maximalists aren't incorrect by saying that over time, the market will prefer one, it'll tend towards one commodity. Although that didn't happen, right? We always had gold and silver, and Mises says that that was because it was a special case. It was because that they both almost perfectly embodied the principles of saleability at the same time. But left to its own devices, the market prefers as, you know, the minimum amount of saleable commodities that it possibly can have. And my whole point was that it's not BTC. If we look at the criteria that Menger laid out, it's not really... You're just being dishonest to say that BTC fulfills that criteria the best, at least in my opinion, you know, so.
Yeah. And you make a strong case here. And there's a couple of terms we're throwing around as if people listening might already be familiar with them. And the first, of course, is Karl Menger. Can you kind of go into a little bit about who he was and kind of how he leads us to Mises and so on?
Menger was the father of the Austrian school, and he was Mises' teacher. So he wrote two books that are important for this topic. He wrote, well, one was like a more of a booklet or an essay. That's Origins of Money. And that's where he lays out the criteria for saleability. So there's spatial saleability, and he's describing things that can constrain the spatial saleability of a commodity. And then he lays out another list of criteria of things that can constrain the temporal saleability of a commodity. That is in Origins of Money. That's a great book or a great little essay to read. It's short, quick. You can bang it out in a night. Highly, highly recommend it for anybody interested in this stuff. The other one that's relevant to this discussion is Principles of Economics, which I just absolutely love because it's written in like the 19th century, but it's very easy to get through and it's extremely important. And it really does cover the base fundamentals of Austrian economics. And he says, if you flip through the pages, get to page 272 to 280, he describes how he talks about store of value, the function of money being a store of value, and how it's just complete nonsense. So I don't know. This is what I wanted to ask Seif. You know, if you're such an Austrian economist, it's great. I love it. Did you miss that part of the book, though? I don't understand. Maybe I'm reading it wrong. I don't know, but it's all written in plain English. So I'm not really sure. The store of value stuff to me is most easily refuted. I know I'm kind of jumping around. You asked about saleability, but
no, that's all right. No, it's good because that is the argument that they've now, the BTC maximalists have glommed onto, right? So all store of value, right?
Well, what's interesting is that this is what I've noticed recently, because now Nick Szabo has been starting to pick fights with me on Twitter, is that so the community, the maximalist community is divided, right? So half of them are followers of Saif al-Din, and they claim that they accept regression theorem, and they claim that regression, the use value requirement of regression theorem is satisfied vis-a-vis the store value mechanism. Mm-hmm. But Karl Menger and Ludwig von Mises both say that this is impossible. They say that the primary function of money cannot be value storage. It's not possible. Mises even goes so far as to say, there's going to be economists who are selling you lies. Don't believe these people. So, but now the other half of the community, the Nick Szabo followers, who are just as vicious, they reject regression theorem outright completely and yet still call themselves Austrians, which just shows that they haven't actually read any of the Austrian economics books. They're just paying lip service to this because they see it on the internet and it's popular. So they like to say, I'm Rothbardian and I believe in Mises and all that stuff, but they've never actually picked up any of the books because they're rejecting those theories outright. And it's interesting that Szabo, I asked him, the whole point of Mises' regression theorem was to avoid the circularity that is present when you try to explain money's initial value when you're leaving the initial state of barter. And that's the whole reason why Mises wrote regression theorem. And I asked Szabo this, and then all of a sudden the conversation ends and nobody wants to talk to you anymore. And then they're calling me names and blocking me. So
that's really fascinating. I think you really have struck something here, because it's much easier on Twitter to go back and forth and call you a scammer and a B-casher and a B-trasher and all that stuff, rather than, you know, spend some time with someone who's clearly literate on the subject and quoting, you know, literally founders of the school they're claiming to represent.
Exactly. That's what I don't understand. That's what drives me crazy.
And this quote you have of Mises here in the article is, it smacks you in the face. You know, the functions of money as a transmitter of value through time and space may be directly traced back to its function as a medium of exchange.
I mean, could it be any more, I mean, he couldn't be more clear if he tried.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not sure where the debate is there.
I don't understand it. And I, you know, it's funny too, because I even said to Szabo the other day, I said, he put up this, I don't know if you saw this, he put up this post about making fun of, I guess he's making fun of us, the peer-to-peer cash people, and he's saying something like, oh, well, it's not useful for coffee then. Oh, well, I guess, you know, he's being sarcastic. And I responded and I was like, look, man, I was like, Menger, Mises, and Rothbard were very clear on this. You know, this is a secondary function of money, and it's dependent on its ability to serve its primary purpose as a medium of exchange. And his answer was just like completely nonsensical. It was just like, well, you know, he's the amount of people in the transaction and different kinds of transfers of wealth. Like, I guess he's talking about like dowries and wills and stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. He's very big on anthropology. But I was like, well, how does any of that change the rule? And he's like, well, it doesn't. And I'm like, okay, well, then you've just contradicted your original post. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I really think at this point it's just an emotional attachment. Maybe they're financially invested into BTC. I don't know what it is. I mean, that's all fine. That's great. I understand it. But I'm like I said, I'm here for the freedom-related purposes, not the, you know, this isn't an investment to me. It's an investment in freedom, you know?
Yeah, and for someone to stay in Bitcoin Cash, you know, is one thing, and to kind of quietly do their commerce and their work or their building on the chain and working with BCH, that's one thing. To come out and actively advocate for it or something like it or something close to it and mention it and describe its value proposition is really inviting a whole host of trolls. So I think in a kind of perverse way, it's sort of stealing, not like taking, but the metal. It's kind of stealing the ability of Bitcoin Cash proponents, those who are, again, vocal and out there in public, stealing their arguments, because they're forced to kind of go back and check the record and say, well, gee whiz, like, these guys are all Austrians. You know, they claim the mantle of kind of neoliberalism. And you go back and you look at the arguments as you've done, and it seems that it's the opposite is the case. So
it's clear.
Yeah, and it's kind of a head scratcher, but anyway, the saleability I think you sort of struck on, and you've done a real nice job here in explaining it. And I honestly have not heard anybody take it on and apply it to cryptocurrencies, which is sort of telling in itself. I think if you're not the first, you're really early to that idea. I'm skipping ahead. So it's saleability, but there's also another aspect that BTC maximalists kind of fall on.
Oh, well, there's a bunch of them. So saleability, and also soundness. I think if you look at the requirements for soundness, BTC isn't as sound of a commodity as other, cryptocurrencies. And, there are different elements to soundness. The BTC people focus on scarcity, which also in itself is an odd claim to, you know, prop up your whole argument on, because it's just as scarce as, you know, all the other versions of Bitcoin, which is another story. But that's what they base their whole claim on. And my whole point is, well, scarcity is only one of several elements of soundness, right? It has to be divisible. Sound money has to be divisible, has to be scarce, but it has to be durable, fungible, and so on. And the one that they miss is portability. And I think it's telling because they don't even understand that these are the elements of sound money. They hit me up and they're like, where are you getting this portability thing from? And I'm like, well, Joe Salerno wrote a giant book called Money, Sound and Unsound. And that's where I'm getting it from. And he's quoting an economist, Turgot, her book, Reflections, from like 17-something. I'm like, so this isn't a new idea by any means. I'm like, this is just, Seyfedin is just trying to sell books. That's the only conclusion I can come to. It's really the only conclusion I can come to because it's right there in the literature. And Salerno says that portability in the context of sound money, and I explain this in the article, is just, you know, we're referring to the value to weight ratio. So gold, it was extremely portable because if you wanted to make a large purchase, you wouldn't have to carry around, you know, an enormously heavy amount of gold. You could just take like a pocket full of gold coins or something like that. My whole point is that, all right, so in other words, we're saying that it requires less resources to transport. And this is a point Seyfedin makes, is that one of the only points that I actually liked was that he said something along the lines of like the only resource actually is time. And if you think about it, I think that that makes a lot of sense. Mm. And to be honest, I think he was actually quoting another economist. But anyway, the only resource is time. So it takes more time to transport gold than it would, say, iron, for example. So the same applies to cryptocurrencies, right? It requires more of your time. Time is money. It requires more of your higher fee to transport BTC than it does to transport other cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin Cash, for example. That means that Bitcoin Cash is more portable. All other factors of soundness being the same, right? Bitcoin Cash is just as scarce, divisible, durable, etc. All those other things being the same, but a higher degree of portability implies that BCH is more sound than BTC. So that's the soundness argument that I've been making.
And again, it's another novel approach you have, and why I was so struck by the blog post that you put up there is that these two concepts, I've heard them, you know, in the cliche forms and kind of just thrown about, but I've never heard read someone put them so succinctly and so linearly in like the I would have never called it portability. I've called it everything except for that. And that is a fantastic insight.
Well, what's useful is that now I can, when they come at me on Twitter and they start to try to troll me, I can just say, just read this and then get back to me. And what I found is now that they read it and they're like, oh, that actually kind of makes sense. So, I mean, I guess, you know, they are actually, the more open-minded ones, I would say, are actually coming back, you know. They actually are changing their minds, which is encouraging.
Yeah, and I noticed that at least the rhetoric I saw, and I was desperately looking for it before we came on today. You had a recent back and forth, I think in a Szabo thread with Michael Goldstein, and you know you both were kind of making points, but these were sort of sober, mature points back and forth, and I really appreciated the kind of the level of debate there. But you've hinted at it already. But what has been the general reaction to the post from all sides?
It's been all sorts of reactions. Everybody on the BTC side is like attacking me. Everybody on like the peer-to-peer cash side, the open-minded people are like, hey man, that was great. And you know, I think that there's been a lot of false narratives floating around. So I just wanted to like put my two cents in. And like I said, now I can always refer people to that article. So that makes it easier than always explaining in like some long Twitter thread or something like that. So I'm going to, I'm working on another article now, which I haven't fully developed, about the Lightning Network's compatibility with the non-aggression principle, which I think is going to be just as interesting of a concept. And I think it'll probably drum up an equal amount of controversy when that's ready.
That sounds wild.
Yeah. Just to tease a little bit, I think that if we look at like sort of some of these justice transactions, they include a punishment for deterrence, and deterrence is not acceptable according to the non-aggression principle. So that's what I'm in the middle of, like, researching that whole topic right now. And if I, once I finally get around to writing that, I'll be sure to tag Zabo and Saifedean.
Amazing. Just a novel, really interesting thinker who takes these ideas seriously and can present them in the old kind of theological debates. They used to call it the art or the philosophy of apologetics. And I think you're kind of quickly becoming our main apologist, like the person we want to put out there, because you have the street cred, the meme cred. You don't take yourself, you know, so seriously, but you also take the subject matter extremely seriously. And it shows. I mean, like I say, I've been bumping around these ideas for more years than I care to articulate. And I work in the space, and I've never put them together in quite the way you have. And I think it definitely, you know, I'm not looking for someone to, you know, come to Jesus and, you know, give up all their BTC and run to BCH. I'm saying more that you bring us, you're the Malcolm X, right? So you bring us to the table, man. Like, you are black manhood. You know what I mean?
I appreciate that. I just like the topics, and I'm interested in the economic stuff and the ethical stuff. So really, I'm just, you know, super interested in, I'm really, the truth is, I'm just a big nerd, honestly. I spend most of my time, when I get done here, I'm going back to rereading Principles of Economics from like the third time now. So this is what I do for fun on a Friday night.
Boom. Well, again, it is fantastic to have you out there. I think you elevate the debate, and I think anybody who's a BTC maximalist, and we have some maximalist friends who listen and give us crap all the time, and I think it behooves them to, and now we finally have someone who you can't just discard as a scammer or a, which I'm sure they've you know, put you as, and
oh yeah, oh,
you're another Roger sock puppet and all the rest of it, right? yeah, it's just they have to take your, because you're so involved in the space, you know, separate from this debate, that you have just kind of gravitated towards the idea of BCH rather than coming at it the other way. So anyway, that's a long way to go to say thank you so much for the article, for putting up the good fight, and for really elevating the discussion, man. And lastly, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.